Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Charleston Barn for an event that has a particularly evocative title, Reader's Digest, something that instantly transports everyone over 40 back to the 1970s, dentist waiting rooms where copies of Punch jostled well-thumbed Reader's Digests. Reader's Digest was a publication that probably commissioned more short fiction in its day than any other, so it's a perfect title for an event that celebrates the work of two exceptional practitioners of short fiction, John Crace and Tom Fowler. Tom, nearest to me, and John, furthest away from me. John Crace is a feature writer for The Guardian who has become something of a legend for his writing in Digested Read for G2. As I'm sure you know, he reviews new fiction by condensing it into short narratives in the style of the book itself, and he's acquired something of a cult following, not just from people like me who want to appear absurdly well-read without actually reading novels. In addition to contemporary fiction, he's turned his attention to writing bite-sized pastiches of many classics, including a memorable version of Mrs. Dalloway. His latest book, which came out at the start of this month, is Vertigo, One Football Fan's Fear of Success, a book that has been described as the story of the existential futility that comes from 40 years supporting Spurs. For Sporting Balance, he's also written books on cricket and tennis, and his semi-fictional memoirs, Baby Alarm, Thoughts from a Neurotic Father, followed by the second half, Thoughts from a Male Midlife Crisis. Tom is a highly original and talented new writer whose debut collection of short stories, The Method, won him the International Scott Prize for Short Fiction, as well as the Edge Hill Readers Prize. Tom has that most useful of degrees, a degree in psychology and philosophy, which enabled him to spend, I think, 7 years on the telephone in a particularly exciting office job. This, in turn, led him to wonder what other lives might be possible for him. In 2005, he edited the memoir of a death row inmate, as a result of which he's vowed never to be sent to a US prison. I think that's a piece of advice that we probably should all follow. In 2007, he completed an MA in creative writing, during which he fell in love with a short story. In 2009, he received an Arts Council grant to research and write a novel, which he's working on at the moment, and his short stories have appeared widely. Tom is also assistant editor of the literary journal Short Fiction. What we've agreed is that Tom is going to read first, and then John is going to follow, and at the end, they might have a conversation between the two of them, and then there'll be a chance for questions from you, the audience. So please join me in welcoming Tom Fowler and John Crace.
Hello. I'm Tom, and I'm from Devon. Don't let that put you off. I'm going to read a couple of stories from my collection, maybe three if there's time. So this first story I'm going to read comes from the... make sure you can hear all right. I need to be a bit closer. This first story I'm going to read comes from the dark recesses of my childhood, where I seem to spend most summers down caves, which I must talk to my parents about sometime. They do say the best gift a writer can have from their parents is a dysfunctional childhood. So there'll be no writer's block for me. The story's called The Little Man, and it's I should point out that The Little Man is real. I have seen him on several occasions. Dad is doing his thing with the dark, telling us to hold our hands in front of our faces, asking if we can see them, which we can't. We sit still, me, my sister Katie, and our classmate. The only sound, the drip drip of mineral-rich water falling from stalactites, echoing around the pitch-black chamber. We've heard this, me and my sister, so many times, but it's for Claire's benefit. We asked her in school one day, in the alley they all smoked in. Well, if you're scared, my sister said. Of what? Bats, I said. Spiders. Shut up. Go on, Claire. Go with the freaks, one of them said. Freaks was the most benign of their judgments, but probably the most accurate. Mum used to say God moved in a mysterious way and had made us special for a reason, though she never said what it might be. She used to come caving with us when Sophie, our little sister, was alive. But now she stays at home with the curtains drawn, listening to the same audio novel over and over. We go into her room for an hour after tea each day. She lies there contemplating the ceiling while we tell her about school. We give up trying to see our hands and turn our lights back on. The chamber is vast. Dad once told us you could fit all the people in Devon in here if you packed them in tightly enough. But when me and Katie did the calculations, there was nowhere near enough room, however much you squashed them in. We look in a crystal pool. Dad shines his light into the water and tells Claire about the blind fish. He says how they evolved without eyes, how they use touch to navigate. What do they eat, she says. I tell her that nutrients get washed in from above ground, but she only wants Dad to tell her. Dad, who produces freaks but isn't one himself. Katie and I ignore her and look for another pool we know. Not too far now, you two, says Dad. Sometimes there are shrimps. Their skin is see-through, so you can see all their organs like in an X-ray. There aren't any today, which I know makes Katie sad. I squeeze her hand and we go back to the others. We clamber between the giant boulders that fell here millions of years ago and squeeze into a small passage. Dad leads, and I go at the back because I've done more caving than Katie. Claire goes in front of me, and every time she gets a bit stuck and panics, she kicks me in the face. After a while, we get to my favourite place in this cave. You crawl along for ages thinking it's just cold mud and rock, and then it appears from nowhere. We sit down and Dad tells us to turn our lights out again and begins. Hundreds of years ago, there lived an evil squire called John Cabell, who was said to have sold his soul to the devil. On the 5th of July, 1677, he died, and the terrorized villagers buried him in a stone crypt. On the night of his internment, a pack of phantom hounds came off the moor to howl at his tomb. I can sense both Claire's fear and Katie's excitement. Dad continues. On each anniversary of his death, his ghost was seen leading the shrieking hounds across Dartmoor. To stop his soul escaping, the villagers placed a slab on the tomb and built a wall around it. But still there are reports of a strange red light glowing from behind the iron bars. The evil squire now had only one escape route, tunnelling into the ground. But when he finally got into the cave system below, he got stuck between two rocks where he remains forever. Dad turns his light on, and the beam shines right on the little man. He's about 6 inches tall, and is where a stalagmite joined with a stalactite. It should be white, but is grubby where cavers have touched it over the years. You can see two arms, a body, a face with ears and a nose, and a large hat like a squire's. Dad sometimes brings a little mirror, climbs across to it because he's allowed to, and places it behind so you can see why it's called the little man and not the little woman. But he doesn't today, probably because he doesn't want Claire to see its penis. I swear I could stay down here all day because it's so beautiful. Once, when Mum and Dad had been shouting at each other all holiday, Katie and I slipped away from the main group and just climbed around on our own, looking at all the red and orange fins and white straws. We got a bit lost, but weren't scared. Dad was so cross he just kept crying and shaking me, saying how we could wander around down here for weeks and not be found, which was fine with us. Sophie was the youngest and Mum's favourite. Doctors had said there was a reasonable chance the curse would skip her, so it was a shock when she turned out to be the most disfigured of all of us. It was as if Mum decided she needed more love as a result. The night before Sophie started primary school, Katie and I heard someone crying, so we snuck downstairs. Dad was comforting Mum. We heard him say that science would one day be able to help us all, make us normal. But upstairs, Katie said she wouldn't want to change anything about herself anyway, and I agreed. We leave the little man and head back. We're about halfway to the chamber, in a bit of the passage you can stand up in when Claire gets stuck again. Not because it's too tight, but there's a ledge we have to walk along, and a little drop to the side that I know is only a few feet, but she thinks it's really deep. I tell her to use the ridge on the wall to pull herself along, but I can see she's scared. She just stays there, looking into the wall, like she's on the edge of the top of a skyscraper. You okay back there, says Dad, who's ahead around the corner. We're fine, says my sister. Hey, Claire, take my hand. Claire reaches out and starts to move along the ledge. Katie looks at me and I nod. Just as Claire goes to take my sister's hand, Katie withdraws it. As Claire falls away from the wall, she grabs at a stalactite with her hand, and it looks for a minute as if it will hold her, but even though it's been there for thousands of years, it snaps clean in two and falls with Claire into the hole. There's a thump when she hits the bottom. I stare up at the stump, which looks just like a broken bone. Years ago, on one trip here, I caught my helmet on the bottom of a small fin and broke the tip off. Dad just told me to be more careful, but I knew he was really angry with me all summer. And that was no big deal, but I know this stalactite is one of the most important in the cave, because apart from the little man, it's the one on all the postcards, and now it's broken. Claire is crying like she's been shot. Dad comes back along the passage and shines his light down on her. He asks her if she's okay, if she can move, but I know really we're all looking at the long piece of white rock next to her. She says her leg hurts, and when Dad tries to pull her up, she screams so loud it hurts my ears, because there's nowhere else for the sound to go. He says she might have broken her leg and they'll need to stretch her out, which makes her cry more. Dad climbs down and uses his belt to tie her broken leg to the other one. He wants me to stay with her while he and Katie get help. He says our batteries should last, but to be safe, to turn one off and wait until they come back. As they crawl away, my sister looks back at me and smiles. It was so much harder for Sophie once she got to secondary school. My sister and I had each other. We shared several lessons and would always meet up in between the ones we didn't. We tried to hang around with her, but it seemed to draw more attention. The thing I love about caves, as well as how dark and wet they are, is how quiet it is, and it's ages before we can't hear Dad and Katie crawling away in the distance. And then it's just us. I try to talk to Claire, but she just snivels. You shouldn't have grabbed that, I say. It's probably been there for nearly a million years, which is an exaggeration. It was your fault. You were making me go too fast. Just then, my light shines on a spider on the wall next to her head, sat there with its eggs, which look like little balls of cotton wool. Claire sees it and starts all the screaming again, trying to crawl away from it. She's shouting to me to pull her out, and when I don't, she takes her helmet off and starts hitting the wall like she's hammering a nail. Stop it, I say. You mustn't do that. But the next hit makes a squelch, and when she pulls the helmet away, there's just a black mark on the wall and another one on the helmet. We just sit there for a minute, not saying anything. I can't stay here, she says. Get me out. I think for a minute. You'll have to crawl through that gap at the back. It loops round and comes back out here, but it's tight. I did it one year. Dad found Sophie gently swaying from a joist in the garage. I know this because Mum went looking for him and her screams brought us in. We all just stood there silently watching Mum trying to get her down. Extracts of Sophie's diary were read out at the inquest, cataloguing months of misery. She got it worse than me or Katie ever did. Nobody was named, just references to the leader, an older girl called C. Claire looks at the dead spider again, and then at me, and then starts to fumble around, pulling herself along with her arm like one of those people with no legs. She finds the spot I mean. She starts to climb through it, but halfway in she gets stuck because her battery pack won't fit through as well. You'll have to take it off. Pass it back to me. When you're through, I'll come round from the other side and pass it through. How can I see where I'm going? She says. I'll shine my light along the tunnel from up here. She thinks about this for ages, then unbuckles her belt, unclips her lamp from her helmet and passes them back to me. I shine my light so she can see along a passage, and she pulls herself along, crying out every time her bad leg touches the floor. Keep going, I say. I'll come round and meet you the other side. She takes ages, and I can hear her snivelling all the way. I look again at the spider's eggs and wonder if any of them will hatch. I read that it's usually about half, and that only half of these survive because the baby spiders, which are called spiderlings, eat each other to survive. I take Claire's lamp and battery pack and drop them in a hole I know that no one else does, and I hear them fall for a second or two before they reach the bottom. I start to make my way back to the main chamber, where there are some helictites I want to draw in my book later. As I crawl further away, Sophie's beautiful face pops into my head. A scene from a camping holiday, the three of us running around a cornfield smiling and laughing, hiding from each other while Mum and Dad put up the tents. I hear Claire shout my name a few times, but after a while I can't hear anything. I think she's found one of the deep drops along that tunnel and is probably stuck between the rock, just like the little man. Thank you. Actually, when I knew I was going to read that story, it reminded me of how often my dad did used to throw me down caves. And there was a very tiny part of this cave that nobody else could go to because I was about 7 or 8. I was the only one that could fit in it. And so for now, there's a part of a cave in Devon, unfortunately named Tom's Passage, which I can do absolutely nothing about. So when you get to the middle of this this book, this collection, you need to pause for breath, really. So there is this little vignette, and it's called Breathe. I want to see if I can breathe in her presence. This basic yet beautiful function, controlled by the brainstem, regulated according to how much oxygenated blood our muscles call for, it's time to test it again. In the heart of night, the breath is usually cadent, its chaste rhythm like the tide, comforting an anxious parent, annoying a sleepless lover. Always there, from the first inhalation after departing the amniotic fluid to the last exhalation at the far end of life, but not mine. When we met, I thought I was allergic to her perfume. That first corporeal connection as the musk caught my single malt-coated throat. But those times she wore none, after a shower or when it had been adulterated by the more viscous sweat of lovemaking, my intercostals still crushed me like a jacket for the insane. It takes just shy of an hour to remove my dusty journals. Small's personality and pulmonary abnormalities, Porter's evidence for the psychosomatic origin of asthma, and several hundred others. The padlock removed, the long box open, I start the timer. I last a stroke beyond 4 minutes before the tightening begins, a whole minute more than last year. I look at my wife. Films and colleagues had led me to believe the bones of the skeleton exhaust their lustre with time, so I'm surprised she's lost none of her inner radiance. The wedding ring has turned around on the proximal phalanx of her third finger, so carefully I correct it. I let her beauty fall on my eyes and then wish her a happy birthday. Thank you. So I thought I could read, perhaps to finish off, with one of the more darker stories in this collection. No, that's nonsense. This is to show you that they're not all dark and foreboding. So this last story is called Team Build. I thought all this team building went out in the 90s. Back then, it seemed every other month I'd break a nail trying to build a dry stone wall in the name of camaraderie. Once the pricks in charge became convinced it increased productivity and profit, there was a bottomless pit of cash for managers to drag their team up Snowdon in the rain or throw them off some cliff dangling on a rope. Nobody complained. For most people, planting an arboretum on Dartmoor or crawling through mud in some pothole was preferable to showing the great unwashed around badly decorated semis in Bracknell. I've moved up from all that now, dealing luxury end of the market, barn conversions, period properties, nothing less than $500,000. But even I can't hit my targets, let alone a performance bonus, building a bloody raft out of pallets and barrels. Christ knows the margins are tight enough these days. It was fine when everyone was a property developer, watching those programmes with the pouting presenters who can hammer a wall through and still look dressed for cocktails as they tell everyone to move up the ladder. Business was, as they say, booming. You only had to show up for your 2%. It didn't matter what the place looked like when you were armed with words like potential and portfolio. People only saw what you described to them. Imagine opening it all up, I'd say. Unearth the house's true essence. Create a space that says who you are. then sell it to the person on the rung below. Everyone was doing it, and there seemed no end. But then the doommongers started muttering about recession, the credit crunch, unsustainable prices, a crash. Talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now nobody's buying or selling, no one's lending. It's a renter's market, which means belt tightening all around. If I told you the repayments on the Beamer, you'd blush. Everything's gone up. Petrol, bubbly, facials, foie gras rocketed. These are tough times for everyone. If I don't get employee of the month soon, Jason says we might have to start renting out the cottage in St. Ives for the winter. The thought of having the world and his wife using our Harrods cutlery and sleeping in the four-poster turns my stomach. Can you imagine my reaction when management announced this trip was compulsory? No doctor's notes, no crying off last minute. It's only 2 days, they said. Bring us all together. Harmonise our energies. I've already counted 13 bruises on my leg alone from the paintballing yesterday. It was the most ridiculous sight imaginable as we clambered over tree trunks in camouflaged overalls and helmets that flattened your hair for the rest of the day, trying to capture and defend territory. It was like one of those wars you read about in the Sunday supplements. It wasn't a total waste of time, though. Just after lunch, I got Caroline from close range, plumb on her size 12 behind. Too many oysters, not enough hours in the gym. She made a noise like a cat being run over. Sorry, I said. Sensitive triggers, aren't they? We're on the same team. Same team. There are no teams in this business. At least she can't sell anything this weekend either. She's 9 points behind me, but then she has been for the last few months, only to offload a 5-bed in the suburbs an hour before deadline. I swear she's fucking the boss. I mean, we all have at some time, but coming from behind to win 4 times in a row takes the piss. On top of the bonus, she's had a skiing weekend in the Pyrenees, dinner for two at Gordon's new place, and audience tickets for Deal or No Deal. I'll just have to try harder. The lodge we stayed in last night was barely fit for savages, not a freestanding bath or heated towel rail in sight. I was too exhausted to stand in the utterly lacking in power shower, so just collapsed on one of the slabs that passed for beds. And you'd think we'd deserve a proper breakfast after all that. Some smoked salmon and filly on a cinnamon bagel, a hot latte. Oh no, there was a vat of what looked like gruel and some stewed tea in plastic cups that I wouldn't serve to our cleaner. There was no alternative on offer, so I shut my eyes and pretended Nigella had knocked it up. Today's canoes are Canadian kayaks, apparently. You know, the ones that that man on TV knocks up in 20 seconds out of a box of matches and some twine. Craig must have picked up on the tension between Caroline and me yesterday, as he's deemed it beneficial for us to share a cockpit downriver. Caroline makes a joke about using me as a paddle, which only a few people find funny. I tried to think of a witty retort about her bringing more makeup with her than anyone could use in a lifetime, but Craig blows the whistle on his life jacket and we're off, 10 of us climbing into 5 canoes with the dexterity of newly born giraffes. I make sure I get in the back of ours. I can't have Caroline's face staring at the back of my neck. When you've been under the knife, angles are important. The water is a gentle ripple, but we're told it gets whiter further down. Most of us drift downstream sideways on or facing the wrong way. Paddles clash or get stuck in the riverbed, some falling in and floating down ahead of us. I'm no rower, but Caroline had the coordination of a drunk. You're working against me, I say, but she's too busy trying not to lose face with the men, whom she thinks adore her, and whom she didn't see all laughing when we found her failed application for the apprentice. Priceless. Can you imagine Lord Sugar putting up with her for more than a minute? She didn't even make the second round, it seems. I mean, if you don't want people to know these things, don't use your work email. I didn't. You're fired, the men giggle to themselves, and an oblivious Caroline gushes at the attention. They all know I'm better than her at this job. She thinks her NVQs count for more than the $2,000 I've spent on neurolinguistic programming seminars this year. Dr. Rob taught us that to master our destiny, we must first master our minds. So every hour I say my meta mantra. Nothing has any power over me other than that which I give it through my conscious thoughts. Jason says it was money better spent on a timeshare or hot tub. But if you have to invest in yourself, in your potential, if you want success, you are your own best asset. It's win-win when you think about it. We finally get the canoe pointing in the right direction and lead the way down the river. We've been told to look out for herons and kingfishers, but if there was any wildlife, our arrival has scared it away. I've never understood people who go on about nature, choosing to stay in a tent, walking for the sake of it. Don't get me wrong, I can lie on a beach with the best of them. When there was that health furor with the sunbeds, Jason and I flew to Tenerife 4 times in 1 year to top up. But why be outdoors when it's cold or wet? That's what nature programs are for. And as for living out here, all those smells from farms, miles from a decent restaurant or salon. I read last week that people live here because they find it less stressful. But what could be more traumatic than spending half of your life reversing up roads because someone forgot they needed to fit 2 cars on them? It's here they need a congestion charge. Not that we live in the city, you understand. That would be too terrible for words. You need a balance, as my life coach says. 2 of the men, Greg and Rich, have found some rhythm and speed past us looking smug. They're still wet behind the ears, poor things. Ordered Merlot at the annual dinner last month, bless, which had me and Jason in fits. They flick more water than they need to into our path and I give them the finger. Come on, says Caroline, let's race them. She slaps the water with her paddle, getting me wetter still. There are a few cheers from behind and we take up the challenge and pursue the men. Within a couple of minutes, we've rounded 2 bends and left the others behind. The men, seeing us catch up, have put their backs into it and pull away. As the river narrows, it starts to froth and flow faster, meaning we have to paddle less for speed but more for direction, as small rocks sit up in our way. After a few minutes, a fallen tree is blocking almost half of the river, and I can see the men glancing back in anticipation of some excitement. We need to get across to the other side, I say. You're the one who's supposed to be steering. As she tries to put in some big strokes, her paddle merely skims across the top of the water and hits me hard in the side of the head. Fucking hell, I scream, you stupid bitch. You've got a helmet on, stop moaning. Come on, they're getting away. We manage to miss the tree, although its top branches whip us as we pass. There are actual waves now bumping us about, and I can feel the porridge slopping about inside me. Every time Caroline paddles, I get a face full of water, and I can only imagine how dry my skin will be after this. Paddle the opposite side to me, shouts Caroline, but it's all I can do to not drop mine in the water. Through the spray, I can just make out the men who seem further away. The waves form a whirlpool, and as we hit it, our canoe lunges to the right, and I'm sure we'll both fall out, which they definitely didn't tell us might happen. Then we're flung to the left just as far before the front dips and I fall forward, crashing into Caroline's back. Let go of me, I hear, and I realise my arms are wrapped tightly around her waist, which is thinner than it looks but could still do with a few sessions of lipo. Grab your paddle, she says, which I see is still on the floor. The front of the canoe suddenly bucks up, sending me back to my half, although I'm facing the wrong way. As the whirlpool spits us out, I can just make out 1 or 2 walkers on the riverbank, though it's impossible to say if they look shocked or disgusted. I manage to turn around and sit up, grabbing my paddle, and we're off again, Caroline shrieking that we need to go faster. We soon spot another tree lying across most of the river, and there seems no way we can miss it this time. We need to get to the bank, I say. We can go under it. I look for the men to see if they've made it, but there's no sign of them, just white waves spitting upwards. When I say duck, says Caroline, duck. I'm about to protest, but my open mouth fills with water and I just splutter and choke. I cry if it wouldn't give the bitch as much pleasure as a sail. The rapids take us towards the trunk, and I can see there's a gap beneath that tapers to nothing where it meets the water. Caroline looks back at me, her eyes intense and excited. Under there, she says, pointing to where the tree is highest. I start paddling hard, but this turns the boat sideways. No, you stupid! Caroline tries to correct it, but it's too late and we shoot towards the tree. She forgets about shouting duck and crouches down as much as she can, and her end of the canoe heads straight for the trunk. There's a thud and a yelp for her, and this time we do capsize. The water takes all my breath and my head goes numb. Everything turns black and silent. I panic, trying to work out which way is up. Feeling around, I find two legs kicking out, and I use Caroline's body to pull myself to the surface. I stand upright and realise it's only a few feet deep. The canoe is on its side, wedged under a trunk. I tell a flapping Caroline that she can stand up. I'm exhausted and shivering. "My arm!" she shouts above the torrent, and I can see that it's stuck between a thick branch and a rock. "Get me out!" I glance up and down the riverbanks to see if we're alone. One of the oars is still in the canoe, so I grab it and start to force the blade between her arm and the branch. What are you doing?" "This might hurt a bit," I say. No, wait, it'll..." I jump as much as I can and let my entire 8-stone frame push down on the oar. Another scream, this time much lower in pitch. The branch moves an inch or so and Caroline pulls her arm out. "There," I say. I feel myself being dragged onto the bank by several sets of arms. Craig's voice is saying something about us going too far, missing the rendezvous point. Someone unclips my helmet and tries to take it off. "Mind the hair," I shout, for a moment forgetting it's been submerged. I'm aware of Caroline being put next to me, yelling in pain as she's placed down. "I think my arm's broken," she says. "She broke my bloody arm." "At least you're alive," Craig says. Lying in this hideous place, I take some comfort from the thought I'll soon be heading home, to civilization, to a hairdryer. "Looks like you'll be off work for a while," I say to Caroline. I can't. Really, I think, as my breathing slows. It's all about the winning for some people. Thank you very much.
Hello. I think any writers in here will probably agree that the one thing writers hate more than anything else is being edited. It's something we all claim to like, but really, I mean, when you've sweated blood over sort of 500 words in a day and somebody comes along and says that 300 of them are rubbish, it's not what you want to hear, especially if it's true. And I think the art of editing and concision has sort of often been lost in sort of modern fiction now, because writers refuse to be edited, and editors are too frightened to edit, because writers will go off somewhere else. So I often kind of feel, having read quite a lot of contemporary fiction, that there's very few novels that wouldn't be improved by being sort of slashed by at least a quarter, sometimes more. Now, the question is whether Daphne du Maurier would agree that you could knock Rebecca down to 1,000 words, but we're going to give it a go. Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again. I swear that the house was not an empty shell, but lived and breathed as it lived before. But I awoke many hundreds of miles away, in an alien land. I wonder what my life would have been like today if Mrs. Van Hopper had not been a snob. "That's Max de Winter," she whispered excitedly in the lobby of the Hotel Côte d'Azur. "They say he's never got over the death of his wife. We must invite him to tea." "You have a very lovely and unusual name," Mr. de Winter said, as we met alone after Mrs. Van Hopper had conveniently caught influenza. "It's so lovely and unusual," I answered, "that no one will ever once mention it in the book." "No matter," he said, languidly smoking a cigarette. "I shall call you my child, and I shall sweep you off your young, impressionable feet with my aristocratic hauteur and studied melancholia." "Oh, thank you, Daddy," I said, my heart soaring with passion. "You may call me Maxime," he replied. My God, but you are different from all the others. Marry me, my child, and after we have honeymooned in Venice, we shall return to Mandalay. The staff lined up outside the front door as we motored down the rhododendron line drive. Good day, Mrs. De Winter, said the tall, unsmiling figure of Mrs. Danvers. Don't worry about Danny, my poor lamb, Maxime said. She was devoted to Rebecca. Now, run along and make yourself at home. I've got some very urgent letters to write and cigarettes to smoke. How slowly that afternoon passed as Maxime attended to his important business, and how greatly I felt the weight of Rebecca's presence as I tiptoed through the east wing. How could I, a mere child, compare to that beautiful creature? Later that evening, we went walking in the grounds, and Jasper the dog went missing along a secret path. Don't follow him, Maxime shouted, his voice turning dark and queer. I ignored him, making my way down to a beach hut further along the cove where a strange figure combed the beach. Get away from Ben the idiot, Maxime said. He's just an idiot. Oh, the other woman was there. Is this where Rebecca drowned? I knew we should never have got married, Maxime said, his voice turning even darker and queerer. Now I shall have to go away to write some letters in London. The days felt endless without Maxime, and the only interruption to my solitude was the unexpected arrival of a bounder. The name's Jack Favelle, he sneered, Rebecca's cousin, and if you'd like a bit of rough and tumble as well. Don't ever mention Mr. Favelle to Mr. De Winter, Mrs. Danvers said, brushing her fingers through Rebecca's perfumed underwear drawers. Just concentrate on making yourself look like that woman in the picture for the Mandalay Ball. Get changed at once, Maxime said darkly and queerly as I made my entrance. I hid in my room sobbing, waiting for Maxime to join me. He never came. Why had I not realized that Mrs. Danvers had dressed me to look like Rebecca? My marriage was over. I could never replace Rebecca in my husband's affections. 2 days later, Maxime reappeared. Oh, joy! Let's start again, I pleaded. I'll be your boy if you don't want me to be your wife. Everything's changed, Maxime said. A storm has washed up a boat with Rebecca's body on board. The police will discover that I shot her. You see, I hated her. Everyone thought we had the most perfect marriage, but she was a cruel woman who taunted me with her lovers and threatened to have their babies. And although I've always treated you like a child, you're the only woman I've ever loved, my child. Oh, Maxime, I answered, I don't care if you killed your first wife. Anyone can make a silly mistake. Just kiss me hard and we can make it better. It's all over, said Maxime, writing yet another letter. The coroner's verdict was suicide. That's what you think, Favelle slurred, helping himself to a whiskey and soda. Rebecca was my lover, and I've got proof you murdered her. My blood ran cold, yet I felt a strange elation. At least we would have another night together before Maxime was hung for murder. Show us your evidence, then, you cad, Maxime replied. Where? Said Ben the idiot. Rebecca didn't love anyone but me, said Mrs. Danvers with a manic, sapphic intensity. Well, I don't think that proves anything very much, said Colonel Julian the magistrate. And as you are very upper class like me, I'm inclined to believe in your innocence, Maxime. But we should go to London to check out Rebecca's mysterious doctor's appointment. So, my child, Maxime whispered as we drove back to Mandalay. Rebecca not only had terminal cancer, she also had a deformed uterus. She was goading me to kill her all along. Oh, darling, I said, I always knew you were only a pretend wife murderer. And look, isn't that Mandalay on fire in the distance? Silly old Mrs. Danvers. I told her not to read Jane Eyre. Believe it or not, that's actually one of my favourite books. I mean, all parody is done with a certain amount of cruelty, but this one is actually done with love. And, I mean, I sort of hope that it comes through as well. I mean, I think that is a staggering work, because, I mean, what else in a book could you have where the title character is dead before the first sentence begins? I mean, that is a work of genius. And for whom the lead title, the woman, her name is never mentioned. And the way she also manages to get you on side with Maxine, despite the fact, I mean, because the brutal fact is that, you know, he did want to kill Rebecca. He thought that he had. And he gets off the hook. And interestingly, in the film of Rebecca, Hitchcock couldn't get, you know, he couldn't cope with that, so that he changed the plot for the movie, where she was sort of killed accidentally, and so although he kind of thought that he hadn't really. But I mean, clearly in this book he intended to, and so there's a really kind of dark plot there. And, I mean, for me, this is one of the joys of doing Brideshead. For those that don't know, it was a sort of idea that publisher had after the Digestive Recon, is to let's go back over the 20th century and do the 100 best books of the 20th century. We'll do 10 from each. I mean, I kind of set the rules. There were 10 from each decade for a kind of symmetry, so the 100 in all, and only each writer can only appear once, you know, because that gets boring. And also the idea that I might have to read Ulysses would be too depressing when I could get away with Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. You know, you don't want to go through 800 pages of something that I'm not going to understand. That was sort of never the idea. And, I mean, it has been a real privilege to sort of go through and actually try and work out why great books are great. And also to try and work out who decides why a great book is great. I mean, who does carve up the literary canon for us? And I kind of started doing some research, and I discovered that in the 70s, it was only in the 70s that the Sunday Times started printing bestseller lists, and that was the first time a bestseller list ever appeared in this country. The Americans had it for years, and the reason, and everyone was horrified, the whole kind of English academic establishment was horrified, because then people might start sort of realizing that sort of people like Geoffrey Archer sold shed loads of books, and that they couldn't work, you know, they couldn't do what's what, and they couldn't carve up the way it things are. So, I mean, although some of these books are undoubtedly great, you know, you sometimes wonder what went missing along the way. Because for the 1920s, I was sort of going through the American bestseller lists, and I was astonished, really. I mean, there was one year, the only book I recognized was Anita Loos's Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I didn't recognize a single other book from the entire year. And that means the whole kind of, I mean, these books must have sold in their tens of thousands, and they're now completely forgotten. And so, you know, there are other books that, you know, sort of seem to fit in with a kind of historical sort of time and frame. I kind of think of Albert Camus' The Outsider, because when I first read it in the 70s when I was a teenager, and I felt it was an immensely important book that spoke to my kind of teenage alienation. And so I was very keen to go back to it. And at the time when it was written, I mean, it was a major work of, you know, the sort of French existential period. But going back and rereading it, it read sort of like Vicky Pollard from Little Britain. You know, kind of like, whatever, why'd you do it? Dunno. And for me, that was quite a kind of sort of... It was quite illuminating, because it was, I mean, in the 1940s and 50s, existentialism was a really kind of threatening, dangered philosophy. And now we've rendered it completely anodyne and mainstream. So we've kind of killed it with just sort of contempt, really, rather than actually taking it on. It's just become so mainstream. And the other thing I realize, I mean, because to write these things, I have to read them quite carefully, because you have to kind of really deconstruct them. And so what I've kind of noticed is that there is different ways in books that are constructed. And Lucky Jim comes to mind, because when I read it, I mean, it is one of the great sort of post-war comic novels, but actually it's a series of about five really big set pieces that are kind of loosely joined together. And it sort of works, but when you see them, they're almost like five connected short stories. And that's sort of a kind of arbitrary link into kind of doing what I hope is a set piece from my new book Vertigo, One Football Fan's Fear of Success. And the idea, I mean, I've been a Spurs fan for 40 years, but that is sort of by the by. It's not wholly by the by, because obviously you have a kind of peculiar relationship with your own club, and I often feel that I've sort of picked Spurs because they're the sort of club who are almost bound to let me down. And they kind of fulfill some psychological need for me. But I also wanted to ask various sort of questions. I didn't want to be a book about football so much as why do I spend so much money doing something that gives me so much pain? What are the kind of rewards there? And I also wanted to write a book that treat it, because so many kind of sport books treat sport as something that happens out there. You have life, you have your work, and then sport happens out there. And I sort of thought, let's bring it all in. This isn't about a history of Spurs, it's about a history of me and Spurs, and so what it says about me and how I kind of live my life through football from time to time. And I've never intended to write about my depression during the book, but in the middle of writing it, I became really depressed, and I didn't feel there was any way that I could avoid writing about it. And although it sounds like a grim topic, I hope that never knowingly sort of think you can probably have fun with almost anything. So this is my attempt at having fun with depression. For a good 15 years now, I've had recurring bouts of depression, not every year or even every 2 years, but regularly enough to know that another one is never too far away. And its time had come again. In some ways, I've got better at dealing with it. There's no longer that feeling of what the fuck is going on I experienced when it first happened, but the sense of abject powerlessness never gets any better. The symptoms are often quite subtle to start with. My sleep will become slightly worse than usual. My anxiety levels will rise. I'll start to catch myself wondering if that funny pain I sometimes get is cancer. And I'll get less engaged than usual. All normal stuff for me. And every other Spurs fan, I should think. Sometimes it stops at that, but not often. Usually what happens next is like falling off a cliff. After a couple of weeks of hanging in, of trying to hold it together, of trying to cope, of trying not to let Jill see that everything is on the verge of going tits up, because I know how scary she finds it, all hell breaks loose. Crippling panic attacks, complete insomnia, and an overwhelming sense of futility. Even getting out of bed feels too hard. At this point, I call in the artillery. I have an ambivalent relationship with my psychiatrist, not helped by the fact that he only usually sees me when I'm in crisis. He thinks his job is trying to keep me well enough not to need to go into a mental hospital. But part of me, obviously not the well part, can't think of anything better than going into a mental hospital, because I was sent to one when I first was diagnosed with depression, and I quite enjoyed it. Not the being ill bit, but the being in the hospital bit, because it's one of the few places I've ever been where I felt totally safe. No one had any expectations of me if I said I wasn't up to doing anything very much. No one so much as raised an eyebrow. And the other patients were some of the loveliest people I'd ever met. They were bonkers, of course, but who was I to judge? There were the depressed, the manic depressed, the schizophrenic, the ones who couldn't stop sleeping, the ones who couldn't stop talking, and the ones, like the New Zealand dentist, who couldn't stop doing both at the same time. It was also the only place I've ever been since primary school where I was congratulated for knowing the capital of France. Every afternoon, the nursing staff would try to hoover up as many patients as they could and make us interact in some kind of communal activity, usually a quiz. Most patients were sensible enough to duck out of this, but I couldn't resist, as I've always been a competitive bastard. "What's the capital of France?" a nurse would ask. I'd say nothing, not wanting to look too pushy. No one else would say anything either, though for rather different reasons. They were either too catatonic to speak, or felt no need to bother with such a ludicrously trivial question. So it would inevitably always be me who broke the silence. "Paris. Well done, John." And so it would continue until the nurse decided enough was enough, at which point I would ask for the final score. "John 23, everyone else nil." I never got bored of that bit. There were downsides to being in hospital, apart from being mentally ill. It was inconvenient. It was worrying for the family. It interrupted my work and my football. It's surprising how vocal people who've done nothing but stare at the wall all day can become when somebody suggests watching something on TV they don't like. It was also an eye-opener to discover that not everyone else wanted to watch football. I'd thought it was only Jill. Not necessarily for all the right reasons, then. I'd steered clear of being an inpatient since the first time I'd been seriously depressed. And on balance, I wasn't that keen to try it again now. Spurs were playing AC Milan in the last 16 knockout stage of the Champions League, and after telling Jill how I couldn't possibly not go to Milan the previous November to see Inter, as there might never be another chance to see Spurs play in the San Siro in my lifetime, I had tickets to return less than 3 months later. I just wasn't sure if I was up to it. I liked the idea of being there. I just couldn't imagine me getting there. It felt too far, too difficult. I could barely make it to the end of the road to get a paper in the morning. How was I going to get to Milan? So when I saw my shrink a few days before the game, I was half hoping he was going to let me off the hook and tell me to stay at home. "I've got this other problem," I said towards the end of the session. "I've got a ticket for the Milan game, and I was wondering if it would be a mistake to go." "Are you mad?" he replied. I wouldn't be here otherwise." "You're right. Sorry." Never underestimate the value of a shrink with a sense of humour. I meant, how could you not go? If I could get off work, I'd go myself. I've been a Spurs fan for decades, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Who would have thought it? A shrink who understood that a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity could come round twice in 3 months. Perhaps we were both certifiable. This is when we get to the game with my friend Matthew. "You know what," said Matthew, the moment our friends were out of earshot, "the San Siro doesn't feel nearly so imposing second time. In fact, it looks a bit tatty." "Don't start up about Stratford again." Matthew had bought into the Tottenham director's dream wholesale, and for the last couple of weeks he'd done nothing but fantasise how, if we won the Olympic Stadium bid, our new ground would be the last word in concrete modernist neo-fascism, and that clubs from all over the world, and especially elsewhere in North London, would be sick with envy and mentally crushed before a ball had been kicked. He was right about the San Siro's tattiness, though. The stadium was showing its age. Even at White Hart Lane, the roof doesn't leak when it's raining. But it was still one hell of a ground. Back in October, the ground had been little more than half full, and the Inter fans had been indulgent towards the pockets of Spurs fans who were sitting in the neutral seats. This time, there were more than 75,000 in the stadium, and everywhere, except for the Spurs end, was decked out in red and black. We had missed the loyalty point cutoff and were back among the neutrals. Only it didn't feel very neutral. Fuck me, said Matthew. We'd better keep our heads down. When I'd seen our team sheet, it hadn't occurred to me our heads would ever need keeping up. Most of our good key players were still out. But then the incredible started to happen. It was AC who looked nervous. Our marginal players were immense, and while we didn't create too many clear chances, we didn't look to be any great trouble. I can't believe this, I said. We could get a result here. Imagine coming away with a draw. It's astonishing, Matthew replied. Bolton gave us more trouble than this. Inevitably, AC came harder at us in the second half, but Gomez made two stunning saves and they couldn't break us down. And then, with 10 minutes to go, we took the lead. Lennon ran from the halfway line, beat a couple of defenders and squared the ball to Crouchy, who slid it into an open net. I couldn't help myself from standing up and started yelling, "Yes!" Immediately I felt Matthew tugging on my arm. "Sit down, you fucking idiot." I looked round to find I was the only person standing in the whole of our section of the ground. I smiled sheepishly and tried to pretend I'd only stood up to stretch my legs. Amazingly, I got away with just a few disapproving glares. Either the AC fans were a lot more forgiving than most, or they were all numb with cognitive dissonance, incapable of accepting that what had just happened had happened. It hadn't been in my script, so it was unlikely to have been in theirs. And then this is sort of back to the depression again. Jill had been trying to get us to. She'd given up work she'd changed jobs and had a month off, and she was trying to pester me to book a holiday at the same time. And it said Jill's displeasure was rather less petty, as she had been trying to arrange our own spring holiday. She had just handed in her notice at work, was taking a month off before starting a new job, and wanted us all to go away for a week. I can't afford to take the time off, I had pleaded. It's amazing you've managed to go to Milan this month, then. It is, rather. There wasn't much point trying to explain the difference between sneaking abroad for the night to see the most important game of the season and trying to find a convenient 7-day stretch in the second half of April when Spurs weren't playing, a near impossible task given the danger of postponed games being rescheduled, or of me just cocking things up as I had 4 years previously by failing to check on the UEFA Cup dates and finding myself with no internet or mobile phone access in the middle of a South African game reserve, rather than at White Hart Lane for the quarter-final tie against Seville. This year, thankfully, I had a rather better reason for being obstructive. My depression. Every cloud has a silver lining, I suppose. You might have thought that a holiday would be just what you need to cheer yourself up. Jill had once thought that when she booked a holiday to La Gomera, one of the least inhabited of the Canary Islands, while I was depressed. I sat by the pool for a week, either reading a book about the firebombing of Dresden or staring catatonically into space while she tried to entertain the kids with the island's 2-star attractions, a piece of uneven concrete doubling as a crazy golf course and the German nudist beach. We hadn't tried that again. That didn't stop Jill finding me annoying, though. Living with someone who is depressed must be almost as bad as being depressed. There's no standard rhythm or logic to depression. You know you're losing touch with reality. You can't be talked out of it, and you just have to hold on as best you can through the white-knuckle ride until it lifts. And you have no idea when that will be, so there's no point making any major plans for when you might be well again. Even more infuriating for her was that beyond just about holding my job together and trying to deaden the panic attack, and by deadening the panic attacks in the gym, the only thing I could really manage was going to the football. She thought it typically perverse of me. It may well have been, but it wasn't deliberately so. She saw me as someone putting himself into her twin visions of hell, Ryanair and a huge crowd of football fans. I just saw myself just doing something that had to be done, something that required nothing of me beyond showing up. I could shout or stay quiet as I pleased and no one would judge or notice. At the best of times, the idea of milling with crowds of shoppers on the high street makes me anxious and homicidal. yet even when I'm nuts, I feel safe in a football crowd. Over and beyond a common sense of purpose with everyone else, I feel as if I'm in a bubble where there's nothing getting in between me and the moment. All the other worries that are invading my psyche 24/7. You're gonna die, John. It's only a matter of when. Dissolve for a few hours. There is no me, only football. It's the most perfect time off, time out from myself. Knowing there are football matches, and therefore moments like these ahead, is one of the things that helps me survive those days when every minute feels like an hour. A still more surprising side effect of my depression is that it took a period of mental illness to inject a temporary note of sanity into my football watching. Like every fan, I want to believe that my being at a game somehow has an impact, that if I wasn't there, something different would have happened. To an extent, this is true. My driving has almost certainly caused the blood pressure of other road users on the M40 and M6 to spike from time to time. But what my attendance definitely hasn't done is altered the result. Any correlation between me wearing a lucky shirt, shouting at a referee to give a penalty, or booing John Terry to get him to lose his rag and get himself sent off is accidental. And yet part of the collective delusion of being a fan is the notion that your participation and involvement can make an incremental difference. By willing something enough, you can get what you want. It's like being an American for 90 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. We've got the chance for some questions from the audience now. We've got a roving mic at the back there. Would anyone like to kick off with a question? Peering into the gloom, but I can't see any hands going up. Yeah, there's one at the front. Yes, or you still start off here?
I'm curious. Comedy writing is some of the hardest to pull off. I was wondering, do you have a reliable guinea pig that you try your writing out on before you?
No, not really. I mean, my family make a point of not reading or laughing at anything that I do. I kind of work on the assumption that if I find it funny, then it's sort of in with a shout, and sort of take it from there. I know that I've got one friend who I know not to read anything to, because he again sort of just makes a point of being stony faced from start to finish, and I would be suicidal if my career would have ended long ago.
The question down here.
Would you like the mic?
I'm very intrigued by the fact that you've chosen short stories as your sort of area. Bit of a graveyard of expectant, hopeful writers, and I wondered why you'd chosen that rather than novels. Or do you think that it's now coming into its own with everyone having much shorter attention span, so they can't actually cope with novels any longer? I mean, you know. Anyway, I'd be interested in your view on that.
Yeah, that's great. You managed to sneak about three questions into one there, I noticed. There's a definite renaissance in short fiction. I'm not convinced by the shorter attention spans that's the reason. I think short stories have to be savoured possibly more so than a novel. You know, a great big weighty book that you can dip into while you're doing other things, 10 minutes, chuck it away. I think stories deserve to be read in one sitting, and often that's, you know, that is 25 minutes, half an hour. I don't think I chose short stories, and it would sound pretentious to say they chose me, so I won't say that. I came late to fiction in general, but I came even later to short stories. But it was just, they got under my skin, and it's just the scope that the short story has of what it can achieve started to really impact on me. And just reading the great short stories, I suppose, and then realizing that they resonated more, they stayed with me far more than some of my favorite novels, which I never thought I'd say, because the short story is a pure form, really, and it's, I think that's where its power lies, because even the even some of the best novels sort of lumber along and creak because they have a necessary structure and contrivance about them to satisfy elements of plot. Whereas the short story is, again, this sounds pretentious, but it's a sort of fugacious, ethereal thing that can't easily be pinned down, and it has so many wonderful qualities. And I think, I think the fact that it's less commercially viable is undoubtable. But I think publishers have to probably take most of the brunt of that blame. I think that there is a real evidence of a renaissance here. I mean, they've always been popular in other countries anyway. I mean, you go to other countries and they in America, and there are just short story writers, and they are held in as much esteem, if not more, than the novelists. I think it's just here, really, that there's this sort of literary hangover with the novel, the Victorian novel, and we've always seen short stories as something that can be the secondary, and that people do for a little bit of fun or vanity reasons, which is absurd. They are, the good ones are not even the good ones. They're harder to write than the novels in lots of ways. So, but yeah, so it's a fascinating question, or three questions, but
Do you want the mic? So, sorry, we belong to a short story writing group.
Mm.
But anyway, we
Thank you. Have you got other questions? John, don't you think you'd have been happier supporting another team? I just wondered, Chelsea possibly, or...
Well, I have a theory about that, because I think one of the things that appeals to me is Spurs fail so that I don't have to in some way. And I kind of feel that if I was supporting Barcelona and watching sort of inch-perfect passes sort of day in, day out, my own sense of inadequacy would grow larger and larger, really. And so I kind of think a team that can go from the sublime to the idiotic within a sort of whisker is probably temperamentally we're suited.
I can see that.
I get that with cricket myself, and you live your dreams vicariously, your sporting dreams vicariously, and obviously we were rubbish at cricket for so long, and then very, very occasionally you get some ridiculous, absurd, magical victory, and you were beside yourself, you were ecstatic, but now of course we beat everybody and it's just dull. Be careful what you wish for, isn't it?
And Tom, have you had a bad experience with estate agents? Is there something autobiographical in this?
Has anyone had a good one?
Yeah, I have no idea where that story came from. I mean, often people say, where do stories come from? And I think most writers dread that question, really. I don't know where that story came from. It does break up the more somber, foreboding tales in the book.
Showing the dark side of a state agency. Do we have time for sort of one final question?
Oh, yeah.
And then, yes?
Please. Could I just ask John, you said that during your times of depression, you can only go to football.
Yeah.
So does that mean that during those periods you don't write at all?
Well, I mean, I had to do some writing. My work, very, very... understanding, and I mean, I have no problem kind of talking about, I've made no secret of my mental illness with them, and so whenever I feel I can't do it, I just sort of say I need and they just give me whatever space
and time.
And I often find that I need to write something, because if I just dismantle all structures, then all hell breaks loose. So, I mean, I would keep doing sort of a digested read a week for, I'd do kind of maintenance writing, really.
And post-depression, do you find it inspirational, the fact that you've been through that period?
It's not something I would recommend, but it's, but I mean, it's become a resource on which to, I think sort of writers just... Yeah, I mean, everything is material in the end, and I mean, different writers use it in different way. I mean, my tendency is towards comedy, but also to try and find a truth in the comedy as well.
So you and Stephen Fry.
I wish.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to end it there. I just want to thank both speakers for really wonderful readings. Dark, humorous, warm, very moving. And you've got the chance to continue the conversation at the bookstall after this and to buy copies of their books. But please join me in thanking very much both our speakers. Thank you.